This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. We've been reporting this week that the federal government wants to spend $100 million to unravel the complex circuitry of the human brain. Someone else who's been thinking a lot about the brain is a guy I've wanted to speak with for a long time, the legendary inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil. He's done pioneering work in optical character readers, flatbed scanners, electronic keyboards for musicians and beyond. Kurzweil has thought a lot about the ways that technology and human beings are becoming more intertwined, and his latest book is called How to Create a Mind. Ray Kurzweil, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The brain is a spectacularly complex organ, and we're learning more about its mysteries all the time. But I want to ask you, the more we know about the brain's complexity, what leads you to believe that there is really any way that technology could emulate it?
Well, it's complex in that it's not complex. There's a tremendous amount of redundancy. I mean, there's not that much information in the genome. So there's hundreds of trillions of connections in the brain, but there's only 50 million bytes of information in the genome that describe its design. So the model that I provide in the book is that we have these pattern recognition modules that recognize a pattern. They learn a pattern, and then they are organized in hierarchies. And this is how the neocortex works, which is 80% of the weight of our brain and where we do our thinking. And that hierarchy we create with our own thoughts. But these 300 million pattern recognizers are pretty much the same across the entire neocortex. This was noticed 50 years ago by a neuroscientist, Vernon Mountcastle, that the neocortex, the types of neurons used, the connections, were uniform across the entire neocortex, which covers the entire brain. And I provide a lot of evidence in the book that there's tremendous interchangeability. So one region that called V1, which generally recognizes very simple visual features like the crossbar to a capital A, what happens to it in a congenitally blind person who's not getting any visual images? It actually gets harnessed by the frontal cortex, which deals with very high-level concepts like humor and beauty, and starts to deal with high-level concepts in language, showing the complete interchangeability, because high-level concepts in language and simple features of visual images are at opposite extreme ends of the spectrum of complexity. So the brain is complicated, but it's not a level of complexity that we are unable to understand. I describe a model for how it works. I'm describing how that model is actually used in artificial intelligence. One technique that I helped pioneer in the 1990s, hierarchical hidden Markov models is the technical name, is mathematically very similar to how the neocortex works. And I'm actually working now to apply similar kinds of hierarchical techniques to developing artificial intelligence and enabling computers to actually understand natural language. That's what I'm doing at Google.
But it's such a fascinating conclusion that you come to, this idea that the brain isn't so crazy complex that we can't try to find artificial ways to emulate it, that in fact there are some basic rules that are working, and that might in the end lend itself to making progress in artificial intelligence.
Right. I mean, there has to be massive redundancy because there's no way that the genome could specify, you know, exactly where each of the hundreds of trillions of connections are. And, you know, I've described this module that can recognize, remember a pattern and connect itself to other patterns, and there's 300 million of them. And those modules are described maybe once or twice in the genome, not 300 million times, because they're all largely the same. And the complexity of the connections actually comes from the complexity of our own experience, because it's not only does our brain create our thoughts, but our thoughts create our brain, this hierarchy, which starts with very simple visual and auditory features and goes all the way up to humor and beauty and irony. We create those connections, you know, from the moment we're born or even earlier. So it's true you are what you eat, but it's even more true that you are what you think. And our ability to see inside a living brain is growing exponentially. You and I have talked about exponential growth, and one of the things that's improving exponentially is the spatial resolution of brain scanning. And we can now see inside a living brain and see it in real time create these new connections and see these connections firing and see our thoughts create our brain. And then we can use that information to create these biologically inspired models and, you know, build intelligent machines, you know, using similar principles.
Let me ask you something probably overly practical, but practical. Many of us are getting worse at certain mental tasks because of technology. We may not remember facts like we used to, how to convert miles to kilometers quickly, things like that, because we know we can look it up online.
Well, controversy existed when I went to college. There were these little devices that looked like cell phones that are called calculators, and the controversy was, oh, kids aren't going to learn arithmetic. And guess what? Kids don't know arithmetic as well today, but the calculators have not gone away. These are properly brain extenders. We are much smarter than we are, than we were, you know, decades ago. I've been managing work teams for 45 years, and I can now have a group of two or three people for a few weeks accomplish what used to take a group of 100 or 200 people years. We're definitely more productive and more intelligent. We now have access to all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. That wasn't true, you know, a decade to a decade and a half ago. And these are properly part of who we are. I mean, during that one-day SOPA strike, I felt like a part of my brain had gone on strike. And they're not going away.
This is when we stayed off the internet to protest legislation in Washington to restrict intellectual property. And you felt like what at the time?
I felt like a part of my brain had gone on strike because, you know, I rely on Wikipedia and Google and all these brain extenders. But, you know, they're not going away. And they are part of who we are. We create tools in order to extend our reach. You know, 1,000 years ago, we couldn't reach the fruit hang from a higher branch, so we created a tool to extend our physical reach, and we now extend our mental reach. And we ultimately will very directly make ourselves smarter by putting computers directly in our brains, even though the computers now are, for the most part, not in our brains, although a few people have computers connected into their brains, like Parkinson's patients. But even if we, you know, interface with them through our fingers and our eyes, they're still really extensions of our brain.
Well, in fact, you project this forward. You think a crucial part of what our brain does now could live in remote computers, the so-called cloud, and this would lift us up. It would be an extension.
I mentioned we have 300 million pattern recognizers. So is that a big number or a little? It was big enough to be the enabling factor to allow humans to create language and art and science and technology. But it's also very limited. You know, anytime you're confronted with the difficulty of learning a new skill or a new language or even just reading a book, we confront the limitations of only having 300 million fairly slow pattern recognizers. We ultimately will directly extend that in the cloud. We'll have nanobots in the 2030s that are small enough to go through the capillaries and basically put our biological neurons on the cloud. And so if you need not 300 million, maybe you need a billion or 10 billion pattern recognizers for a few seconds because somebody's walking up to you that you want to impress and you want to think of a very clever thought quickly, you'll have access to that in the cloud. Just like right now, if you do a complex search or language translation, your cell phone goes out to the cloud. It doesn't happen in that device. Our brains will be able to directly go out to the cloud. And we'll think bigger thoughts, and that synthetic neocortex extender will be faster. We'll be able to back it up. We'll even be able to download knowledge to it. All the things we routinely do with our computers today, you know, all that information in neocortex, and it's not a metaphor. There's really information there. Is not backed up today. That's pretty frightening.
It's just that the link to the cloud better not go down. Google Drive had a problem the other day, and people were without it for a little bit. If indeed a big piece of us is living somewhere else, we need reliability, I guess.
Well, as the internet and as the cloud gets more decentralized and distributed, and it physically is located in, you know, thousands of different places. And if a part of it goes down, then the information can root around it. It'll be massively backed up. We're part of the way there. You know, it's already quite reliable. You know, go out 20 years and there's going to be massive distributed backups. And so even if a piece of it goes down, there'll be plenty of spare capacity.
Ray Kurzweil, you got the culture talking about the singularity, the convergence of human beings and technology. Do you feel we're getting it? Do you feel it's misunderstood?
There's much more understanding, in fact, than there's ever been. The understanding of it is growing exponentially. It's very much a mainstream topic.
What seemed almost outlandish at the point that you were first mooting the point is we're living some of it.
Well, you know, people see fantastic things that seemed like science fiction just a few years ago, and they're taking place now. Young people, I talk to 12-year-olds, and they say, oh, yeah, things were so different when I was 8. Just in the few years that they've been using technology, they see the massive differences. So there's a sense of this acceleration and exponential growth. And it wasn't so apparent, 20 years ago when I started talking about this 30 years ago. And really, there were only a handful of people that were aware that information technology was expanding exponentially and the implications of that. When I talk about computers and artificial intelligence reaching human levels, when I talked about that in even, say, around the year 1999 when the Age of Spiritual Machines came out, that was a very non-mainstream position. We had a conference and we took a poll of artificial intelligence experts, and the consensus view is that AI at that level was centuries away. Then in 2006, there was a conference on the 50th anniversary of the conference that originally gave artificial intelligence its name in 1956, and then we had instant polling devices, and the consensus was 25 to 50 years. Not so different from my view, which has always been 2029, so at that point it was only 23 years away, by my reckoning. Today, it's a very common view that 2029 is reasonable. You know, some people may quibble with that date. Some people think I'm pessimistic. If you look at IBM's Watson system, which got a higher score in Jeopardy than the best two human players put together, and got some very obscure Jeopardy queries correct, like a long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping, and it correctly responded, "What is a meringue harangue?" And it got a lot of, queries, obscure queries like that correct, and it got its knowledge by reading Wikipedia and several other encyclopedias. You know, that's very impressive. That's still not human-level intelligence in terms of the flexibility and scope of human intelligence, but it really should give us confidence that we're, very much on track to accomplish that by, 2029.
Are we going to know when the singularity arrives? Will we see it right away?
Well, the singularity is really the implication of the exponential growth of information technology, and exponentials have two characteristics. They're completely continuous. There's no point of discontinuity, but they get to a point where they're very explosive, because if you double a phenomena 30 times, you're multiplying it by a billion. Now, we've already seen that. Just since I was a student, computers today are billions of times more powerful per dollar than they were when I was an undergraduate at MIT, and we'll do that again in the next 25 years. At that point, they will have human intelligence, and we'll be combining with them. And so it's a gradual process, but it's one that really picks up steam. Our intuition about the future is not exponential, it's linear, and that's really why my ideas are controversial, because even sophisticated people look at the current situation and then extrapolate linearly. Like halfway through the genome project, only 1% of the genome had been completed. So mainstream scientists said, 7.5 years, 1%, it's going to take 750 years, just like we said. My reaction was 1%, we're almost done, because that's only 7 doublings from 100%. And indeed, it continued to double every year and was done 7 years later. And every aspect of biology as an information technology has continued to grow exponentially since that time. So ultimately, these exponential progressions are explosive, but they're not discontinuous. And so it'll kind of creep up on us. Something like the Turing test is not a clear-cut threshold. There'll be reports like probably fairly soon that, computers passed the Turing test, and critics, probably including myself, will reject those as not being valid. By the time it's unarguably true, we'll have actually passed that point by many years. So it's not clear-cut, but, we already merged with computers. We're so dependent on them. You talked about a tribute took without interacting with people. Sometimes people try to not interact with technology. That's actually very hard to do. We're so dependent on, you know, on these brain extenders we have already, even if they're not inside our bodies and brains yet, although a few people do have them inside their bodies and brains, and that will pick up steam as the technology continues to get smaller. That's another exponential trend.
My last question really, Ray, is about, you know, can society handle this? Let me put it this way. Technology offers so much potential, but we're at a moment in history where progress in technology is so fast and building on itself. And people who went to college and got good jobs are seeing some of those jobs taken over by technology. I saw an example of software that identifies cancer cells. It's like a pathologist in a box. And it's hard to blame the pathologist who spent all that money on a advanced degree from being worried about the pace of all this.
Well, there's two aspects to your question. One is, you know, whether we can actually keep up with the technology. And there the answer is very simple. The technology is becoming more like us than requiring us to become like our old-fashioned concept of machines. When I was an undergraduate at MIT, you did have to be an engineer to use a computer. The common public couldn't use it. Today, anybody can use it. They're becoming more human-like. You can talk to them in natural language. You can ask questions of Siri or Google Now just the way you would ask a friend, and these systems will get more and more intelligent, and you'll be able to talk to them just like a person. So you don't have to be a, you know, technical expert to use technology. It's developing human characteristics, and that's a trend that's going to pick up steam as well. As for taking human jobs, that is a controversy that started in 1800 with the first wave of the Industrial Revolution, which started in the textile industry in England and gave rise to the Luddite movement. And it was very clear to the Luddites, who were weavers, that employment was on its way out and would be only enjoyed by a small elite because their friends were replaced by machines, and, you know, one person operating these new machines could do the work of 20 or 30 people, and there were new and more powerful machines being introduced each year. But ironically, what happened is employment went up in England. The common man and woman wanted more than just one shirt. Now they could have a whole wardrobe. New industries arose. There was general prosperity. And if you look at the trends of the last couple hundred years, that's continued. 100 years ago, a third of the population worked on farms and a third worked on factories. That's now about 2% each. So you might think that there's massive unemployment, but in fact, the number of people with jobs, the percentage of the population working, is actually double what it was in 1900. And 65% of the jobs today are, you know, creating knowledge of one kind or another. They're in knowledge-creating industries. The majority of jobs today didn't exist 25 years ago, let alone 50 or 100 years ago. And that's why it's a difficult issue because, you know, if I were a Prussian futurist in 1900 and talking to these farmers and factory workers and saying that, you know, all those jobs are going to go away, I couldn't say, oh, but don't worry, you'll get jobs as, you know, making online documentaries and being a web designer and designing new chips. And nobody would know what I was talking about. And in fact, you couldn't even describe these jobs. They're in industries that didn't exist, using technologies that nobody understood. The same thing is true now. I mean, we are automating types of tasks that humans do. We generally start at the bottom and automate jobs that require less skill and education. So we've pushed education up. There's only 50,000 college students in 1870. There are over 12 million today. We've spent 10 times as much today in constant dollars per student on K through 12 education to provide the higher level of skills, because we destroy jobs at the bottom of the skill ladder and add new jobs at the top of the skill ladder.
But surely the pace is very fast now. It's your famous analogy about we're in the second half of the chessboard. It's possible that the disruption now is going to be at a level that we haven't seen before.
Well, you know, we have new technologies that will enable, for one thing, the human race to live very comfortably. We have three-dimensional printing coming that's going to enable you very low cost to turn information files into physical products, including housing at Singularity University. There's a project to print out a house, one module at a time, and snap them together Lego style at very low cost. Get to the 2020s, you'll be able to print out clothing and organic materials. And so we'll be able to provide the physical things that the human population needs. Already, you know, there's millions of free books and movies and sound recordings that are open source that you can legally download for free. And you'll ultimately be able to live very well with open source information. That doesn't mean the economy will go away, because if you look, in fact, at the music, book, and movie industries, their revenues have kept up with the proprietary forms. Even though you can get millions of, you know, songs and books for free, people still spend money to buy Harry Potter or the latest blockbuster.
Yes, some new data about that just in the last week or so. It's fascinating.
So, you know, at the bottom line is you have access to a lot of free information, and ultimately you'll be able to live very well on that, but people will still spend money for proprietary forms of information. And we'll be doing lots of new kind of creative tasks and jobs that may be organized very differently than the sort of 9-to-5 jobs that people are used to today. They'll be more creative and more flexible. But, you know, the welfare of the human population, I think, is in very good shape, because we'll be able to meet the needs of our population with these new technologies. I mean, take energy. Solar energy is doubling every 2 years, and it's only 6 or 7 doublings from meeting all of the world's energy needs, and we have 10,000 times more free sunlight than we need to meet all of our energy needs. And the similar technologies emerging in water and food production. So I'm not concerned about meeting the economic needs of people, and as for their need to be sort of expressive and creative and be able to work in a way that provides satisfaction and self-definition, there's more and more opportunities to do that in a very broad, diverse set of ways. You know, just writing blog posts, for example, that's a whole activity that didn't exist at all 5 years ago, and, you know, people express themselves and are very creative. I think we're going to organize the economy differently. But I think we basically will continue this trend of creating new types of work that didn't exist before.
Inventor, technologist Ray Kurzweil, his latest book is How to Create a Mind, The Secret of Human Thought Revealed. Mr. Kurzweil, thank you.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.